From CPR News, this is Colorado Matters. Mapping trajectories in space is tricky.
If you have a spacecraft and the Earth and the Moon are both gravitationally pulling on it, weird things start to happen.
Oh, it's being pulled between mom and dad.
Exactly. You actually get gravitational parking spots that start to form around the Earth and the Moon.
We meet a remarkable grad student at CU and don his experimental goggles designed to make astrodynamics easier. Then a tree sleuth.
I called up the number and Mr. Funk answered the phone and he was very old. He said, "Hello, hi." And I introduced myself and told him I was looking for the tree of Johnny Appleseed. And hold on a moment. He said, "Hey, Dorothy, get the scrapbook. There's a young feller who wants to know about the Johnny Appleseed tree."
Hi, I'm Seth Kent, and I donated a van to CPR. All we needed was the title and the keys. It was really great to be able to make a larger donation like that. We're Evergreen members, but at nowhere near that level. It will take us years to match that, but it feels really great to be able to give a really significant donation to CPR, and it feels like it's put to good use, so that's good too. It is super easy to donate your vehicle at CPR.org.
This is Colorado Matters from CPR News and KRCC. I'm Ryan Warner. Today's show will take you into the high heavens and deep into the soil. A little later, you'll meet some celebrity trees. First, charting highways in space, University of Colorado graduate student Dizelle Turner hopes augmented reality can help companies headed for outer space plot their routes. We met in a conference room on the Boulder campus to try out his technology. Dizelle, glad to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
On the table here is a laptop. You are holding a fancy set of goggles, which I'm going to don in a little bit here. You know, these don't seem like complicated tools for such lofty goals. Tell me what you're trying to accomplish here.
Yeah, so you're about to try out a demo of my PhD research.
Yeah.
I study astrodynamics, which is all about telling spacecraft where to go and how to get there.
I'm going
to
say, I learned the term astrodynamics from you today.
Oh,
astrodynamics.
Yes.
That's like MapQuest in space.
That is a great way to look at it.
Okay.
I'm sort of trying to build MapQuest for planning space missions. So you're about to don a pair of goggles because I think augmented reality, so you're going to see sort of playing with digital holograms, is actually a way to make trajectory design more intuitive.
Now, when I think about, you know, driving, say, from home to the restaurant where I'm meeting my friends, mm-hmm. I want the fastest route.
Mm-hmm.
Often that's the shortest route. Or maybe it's the route that avoids the most traffic.
Sure.
Are there lots of choices for a trajectory if you're going from point A to point B in space?
Yes, you actually have an infinite number of choices in space. The weird thing about space, so you know how in the movies you can just fly straight to wherever you're trying to go?
Yeah.
You can't really do that in space. Gravity won't let you. And there's this infinite number of options. And sometimes the fastest option might cost you the most fuel. Sometimes it might not. So I'm trying to build a tool that really lets people look at all of their options and sort of lets them make those trade-offs in a way that might not have previously been that intuitive.
Not to mention the fact that heavenly bodies like Earth and, say, the Moon, which mm-hmm. I think you're primarily focused on, they're moving all the time.
That's correct.
And so the distances change.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's like you're trying to navigate one giant spinning maze, except the maze is not just spinning, but it's all spinning at different rates, so it's just this big jumbled mess.
And you think the notion of soaking a person in the environment, in the experience of the trajectory, is going to lead to better outcomes?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, that's a great question. And honestly, the way I think about it is the math to design trajectories is pretty complicated.
Uh-huh.
And especially when we're talking about the moon. So you're looking at what we call a chaotic system when you're looking at the Earth and the moon. And all that means is that if you're slightly off from the path you want to go on, you could end up somewhere very wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to build a tool that helps people design these trajectories a lot more quickly so that if I want to go from this point in this amount of time, I can see what that path looks like and then decide if that's still the path I want to take.
The point is accuracy is key.
Absolutely. Decimal points can really change things.
Okay. Well, I guess it's time to don these goggles.
Yeah. So this knob in the back, you can turn it counterclockwise to loosen it. There's a Velcro strap on top.
Okay, I do have a big head. Not that there's any brain material inside, but all right.
So sort of tighten it.
Almost like a construction helmet.
Make sure that you can read. You should see something that says like
holographic remoting player.
So I'm about to stream from the laptop.
Okay.
It's taking a second.
We all know that experience with computers, Dizelle.
Okay, you see that blue arrow?
Yep.
Look where it's telling you.
Okay.
Keep looking.
Looking
just feel
right.
Free to walk around.
Oh, I'm going to move around in this room.
Okay, there's the solar system.
Is that the sun?
That is. If you want to step back just a little bit, you can get a better view here.
Boy, the sun has never been quite so close for me. Now, why are the dates changing at the top, Dizelle?
Okay, the dates actually reflect the exact date and time you're seeing in the solar system here.
Okay.
So you see how the planets are moving around. All of their positions are accurate to that date.
And
so
obviously the sun is the center of the universe.
It is the center of the solar system.
So solar right. System. Yes.
I want you to hold up your hand and close all of your fingers except for your thumb and index finger. So just kind of like an L here. Cool. Now hold it like crocodile jaws sort of out toward the sun, out like that. Do you see a ray coming off of your hand?
Yes.
Let that ray hit the sun.
Okay. Oh, it's like I have a laser pointer.
Yes. If you point that at the sun and then close your thumb and forefinger.
Boom.
Yes.
Oh, it's okay. Like I'm biting the sun's head off. Okay.
Yes. Now you can move the sun wherever you want in the room. So move it somewhere convenient for you because I'm going to have you walk up to it next.
Dizelle, I'm moving the sun.
You're moving the whole solar system.
I feel like a god.
Now I want you to walk up and just stick your hand right into the core of the sun.
Okay.
And grab it, just like you're grabbing it right in the middle.
Whoa!
Fully close your hand. Yes, now you've got the sun. You can rotate the whole solar system. You see the plane of the planets changing.
Yes, I sort of have a clenched fist of the sun. My fist is actually the sun. And everything is moving around it. And so that's the relationship, right?
Yeah, and so that's just a good way to, if you want a different view, if you want to see the planets angled differently, you can sort of change it like that. If you want a better view, so do you see that scale bar if you look down?
Yes. Oh, okay, yes.
You can drag that down.
Oh, I can zoom in and out.
Yeah.
I can see that this would be a far easier experience for someone who was experienced in video games. Did you play video games as a kid?
I did play a lot of video games. My advisor and I are both big video game nerds, so that informed a lot of this.
Does that help in this profession?
Well, maybe not in this profession, but in this specific research project,
yeah.
I'm actually writing all of this using a video game engine. So the same code that would be used to build some of your favorite games is running on the same system I have here.
Why the moon?
One, because you've probably heard the news, but the moon is very popular right now.
It is, almost as practice for Mars.
Yes, yeah, that's one big reason. But why the moon is interesting to me is when you have the Earth and the moon together, it makes gravity a little quirky. So if you have a spacecraft,
yeah,
and the Earth and the moon are both gravitationally pulling on it at the same time, weird things start to happen.
Oh, it's like it's being pulled between mom and dad.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the weirdest part, you actually get some little gravitational parking spots that start to form around the Earth and the moon.
Oh, like little eddies.
Yeah, that's a great way of thinking of it.
Okay.
So theoretically, if you were to put an object right inside of one of those parking spots, it would just stay there.
Really? Little pit stops.
Yeah. What we can do, and what NASA and all of these other organizations really want to do, is orbit these little parking spots. So now you're not orbiting the Earth or the moon. You're orbiting a point somewhere in between or somewhere outside of them. And the orbits aren't typically circular or elliptical. You get some weird sorts of shapes.
Hmm. So could you map for those in the trajectory? Could you find those pockets?
Yes, that's actually the next step for the tools I'm building. I want to expand this for the Earth and the Moon and find those pockets and all sorts of those weird, trippy orbits around those parking spots.
Now, why are those parking spots important?
Because these orbits are not your typical shapes, and because they stay put relative to the Earth and the Moon,
yeah.
You actually get some really interesting benefits out of them. NASA actually wants to put a space station called Gateway in one of these orbits, and it'll look like it's orbiting the Moon, but it's actually orbiting one of those parking spots and coming very close to the Moon.
Could this be a place to fuel back up?
It could be, and so they've sort of built it in such a way that it'll give them easy access to the Moon, but this orbit, because it's around one of these parking spots, it also stays facing the Earth, so that's really good for communications.
Oh, you could put the equivalent of a satellite, almost.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you could do.
Could I experience one of these orbital anomalies?
Oh, I don't have it in the headset here, but I do have a photo on my laptop.
Oh, I'd like to see it. Okay, may I take these off?
Yes.
Okay.
Here's a set of what we call butterfly orbits, and this is a family of orbits around one of these parking spots. You can see the strange wing shapes here.
Yeah.
So again, not the type of orbits that you'd expect that might be circular mm-hmm. or sort of ellipse shaped. Here's another set called dragonfly orbits. I didn't name these, clear theme here.
This looks like a cat with ears.
You know? I see it.
Ears yeah. pointed.
And so again, here's just another strange kind of shape that's not at all the kinds of orbits you'd expect.
What is creating the parking space? What's your understanding?
It's the gravity of the Earth and the Moon and the rotation of the Moon about the Earth.
All of that
combines.
Combines.
Yes.
Wow. And the notion that they are relatively stable in space is like a little lifeline, a little tether in an otherwise chaotic environment.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. I can see why you'd want to study this. Now, this is not any kind of mystery to NASA. So you're not teaching NASA things.
That's correct.
Who would be using this then?
There's a lot of new organizations that really want to send things to the Moon, and they suggest all of these mission concepts that sort of involve using these parking spot orbits.
Mm.
But the problem is not all of them have the resources to do that trajectory design themselves. And so I want to build a tool that makes it super intuitive for people like that to use, especially because even for NASA, when we're designing the paths to get to these parking spot orbits, it's an iterative process. Not everyone at NASA understands how these work. Mm. So it's a back and forth between the different teams so that they can decide, oh, actually, I want the path to go a little further this way. Actually, can you get there a little faster? That sort of thing.
I mean, the space race used to be the US and the Soviets. Mm-hmm. Now the space race is 1,000 different companies.
Absolutely.
And your idea is I can help those companies with this sort of mapping.
Precisely.
And maybe any number of them would hire you as a consultant.
I mean, if they want to.
When I think about, say, the movie Hidden Figures, did you watch that movie?
I love that movie.
Yeah, it was such a good movie. And gosh, when I think about the power your laptop has now versus the kind of blackboard arithmetic that they were doing for those original space missions, it blows my mind where we've come. Do you want to reflect on that for me?
It is pretty insane. All of that computational power we have now has actually led us to find new kinds of orbits. If you look at the Apollo missions, they're basically tracing an ellipse out to the Moon and sort of back. Here, I just showed you some weird butterfly-shaped orbits. There's bean-shaped orbits and cat-shaped orbits. And all of these are things that we didn't really have the technology to find before.
We can see things today that generations past just couldn't see.
That's true. And use them to our benefits.
What are the pitfalls here? What are the obstacles you're running into?
One of the big obstacles is I need to design this system such that it is intuitive to use.
Mm.
If I can't do that, then the holograms will be a hindrance, not a help to people. That's actually part of the reason you're here, is for my own selfish gain, because you're testing it, and now I can sort of tweak the parts that don't work as well.
Yeah, that was interesting. Like, trying to grab the sun, it was a very specific movement that I needed to learn.
It's true.
I mean, you are relying on the user to learn a little something first. And it has to be intuitive.
Yeah, and I think using a particular kind of headset, there's a particular kind of gestures involved with it that I don't really program, but I do have to figure out sort of, okay, with the parts I can control, how do I make this the easiest possible experience for someone?
I mean, that's fascinating because you're focused on the heavens, but then you're focused on user interface.
Absolutely.
Okay. Our guest and my guide in space is Dizelle Turner, graduate student at CU Boulder who studies astrodynamics. We met in a sprawling conference room on campus, so I didn't bump into walls, to test out the augmented reality experience he's developing. The goal? Plotting spacecraft trajectories. We'll be right back with his own trajectory here from a planetarium in Iowa where he grew up, plus the pressure he says he faces as a black student in aerospace. This is Colorado Matters from CPR News.
The state capitol isn't just a stately building in downtown Denver. Under the gleaming gold dome, 100 of your fellow Coloradans make laws that touch your workplace, your commute, your home, and your schools. I'm CPR government reporter Benta Berkland. I've covered every legislative session for more than a dozen years, and I use that expertise to help you understand the politics and the people who run our state. Find that coverage at cpr.org.
If you're headed to a friend's or to work, there are only so many routes you can take. But in space, trajectories abound. Let's rejoin my conversation with CU grad student Dizelle Turner, who thinks holograms can help aerospace companies map trajectories in space more intuitively. Turner is also part of Space Workforce 2030, which aims to diversify the industry, hiring 3,000 paid interns from underrepresented groups over the next 6 years. How did you get interested in aerospace?
The stargazing is really good back home in Iowa.
Not a lot of light pollution.
That's true.
Uh-huh.
Not a lot of anything else, but yeah, so I visited the local planetarium when I was really little, and I just got hooked on memorizing the constellations, and now I'm getting a PhD in the space industry, so really full circle here.
Did the people at the planetarium start to recognize you?
A few did, yeah.
Uh-huh. What do you think caught your attention about it?
I think there's just something so comforting about the fact that we're so small. In the fact that in the grand scheme of the universe, right, like I think we forget just how apart the inner planets are and just how far away Pluto is from the sun, and that's just one star in the galaxy. And I think there's something really comforting about the fact that, wow, all of our problems that seem so big are actually kind of tiny.
You did your undergrad degree at MIT.
Yes.
You're also listed in the Aviation Week Network's 2020s program, recognizing top students in their 20s. How old are you, Dizelle?
I am 24.
24. You're an intern in a space program called Space Workforce 2030.
Yes.
You're wearing the pin, in fact. Why do you think it's particularly important to have a program like that for people from diverse backgrounds?
I think from a practical perspective, it just makes a lot of sense. In the space industry, we're trying to solve some really difficult problems, and you can't really do that if you're not considering all sorts of perspectives. And a great way to do that is by bringing in people from different backgrounds. But also, I really hope that a program like this will help kids who were growing up like me, give them the chance to see themselves reflected in this industry, and maybe they'll be reminded that they do belong.
I understand in concept that the more diversity you have, the more diversity of opinion and viewpoint and experience you have. But practically, what does that mean in a field like yours? Astrodynamics. Dynamics.
Yes. So,
like, can you think of a time where you brought an idea or a viewpoint to a room, maybe a mostly white male room, where you had a slightly different take on it?
I think, honestly, this tool has been sort of an example of that. So this was sort of a joint idea by my advisor and I, so I'm not going to take all the credit for it. A tool like this, not everyone in astrodynamics immediately thinks this is a viable method or even necessary, because experts in this field are used to using their tools. However, I've noticed that in the process of learning everything I need to build this tool, it turns out that not everything is obvious to everyone. And so building something like this has sort of given me a way to sort of see through the eyes of someone else who's a newcomer to this field.
It democratizes it.
Absolutely.
To some extent, do you think you needed that coming into the field?
I think this would have been a big help in my classes.
Yeah. Having the experience of something rather than just the theory of it.
Yes.
You're from Iowa originally.
Yes.
I lived in Iowa, have family in Iowa. It is not a very black place, Dizelle.
That's fair to say.
I'm guessing that you have spent a lot of time in circles with people who don't look a lot like you. Is that true of aerospace?
Yes, it is true of aerospace. However, I have been pleasantly surprised in that there were more people who looked like me than I expected. During my first summer internship at the Aerospace Corporation, my mentor, who had since passed away, but he happened to be black, and I can't tell you just how trajectory altering it was to see someone in the field that I wanted to be in who also looked like me and was also loved and respected by his peers. It was really just this reminder that, hey, I think you can do this.
It's proof that there are benefits in numbers.
Absolutely.
Because the more you see people who look like you, the more you think, I belong here.
Yes.
I'm sorry you lost him. When was that?
That was just this past summer, I think.
Do you want to name him?
Jim Gidney.
Jim Gidney. I love how you used the word trajectory when you spoke of him, because it's a little on the nose, given what we're talking about.
Unfortunate pun, I'm sorry.
Oh, or very fortunate, I think. Did being an aerospace engineer seem possible to you as a child?
Actually, it did. I've always been a pretty naive optimist, so I was kind of like, yeah, I can just do anything. I mean, it's only rocket science.
Well, that's interesting that you frame it as naivete, as opposed to confidence. Particularly confidence in your own desires and abilities. Do you feel like you have that kind of confidence?
No, I do not. I think I really struggle with imposter syndrome. So I think as a kid, it was really easy to just sort of be like, yeah, anything's possible. And then being someone in a field where not a lot of people look like me, I think I do feel this pressure to be perfect sometimes, where I'm afraid that if I make a mistake, that'll reflect worse on me. It's a bit of a struggle. Thankfully, I have a great circle of friends and a wonderful advisor who all remind me that, hey, you are human and that's okay.
Dizelle, thank you so much for meeting me here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Dizelle Turner is working on his doctorate in astrodynamics at CU Boulder. I joined him to test technology he's developing to help map trajectories for spacecraft. A little more on diversity. According to a 2022 survey by the Aerospace Industry Association, about 25% of employees were women, 10% black, 9% were Hispanic, and 9% were Asian. See what I saw in Turner's goggles at CPR.org. From the solar system to the soil, when Colorado Matters continues, we head to Fort Collins to meet a tree with quite a pedigree. I'm Ryan Warner. You're with CPR News and KRCC.
You've probably seen the signs along the highway. Your speed is monitored by aircraft. Through Colorado Wonders, you asked if planes are really checking our speed.
Having a vantage point from the air is much different, and people don't know you're there, and they continue to drive the way they drive. It's shocking sometimes.
The story of a Cessna, a pilot, and his trusty stopwatch in the latest Colorado Wonders, online at CPR.org.
Some trees have human keepers, people who keep their stories in addition to keeping them alive. Like Scott Skogerbo, who tends to an edible nursery in Fort Collins.
If I'm lucky, I have 30 more years of my life. These trees will just be middle-aged. These apple trees can live, 100 years easy. Some of them 200 years. One of the meanings of life is to plant a fruit tree knowing that you may well never eat the fruit from it. When you plant a tree, it's for the next generation.
A clip from A Branch of Us, a new film at Denver Botanic Gardens, about several of these keepers. It made us want to meet Skoger Beau and one very special tree in particular at Fort Collins Wholesale Nursery, where he's worked for 30 years. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Ryan.
This apple tree, you actually have a few of them potted, has some incredible lineage.
These come from the last remaining tree planted by Johnny Appleseed.
And in fact, there is a baby blue label around their very skinny trunks, Johnny Appleseed Apple.
What these trees are grafted pieces off this ancient tree. It's been propagated many times since it died in 1965. The original tree did pass away at over 140 years old.
Where was it planted?
It was planted in Jeromesville, Ohio, on the farm of Roy and Dorothy Funk at the time that I got the cuttings.
I think of Johnny Appleseed as such an integral part of American history, of even my childhood. He planted lots and lots of apple trees.
People often think that he went all the way to the other side, to the Pacific Ocean, but no, he never did. He started in Leominster, Massachusetts, and then as a young man, he went with his brother to Western Pennsylvania, which at that time was the frontier around 1800. Mm. And then when Ohio opened up their territories for pioneers and settlers, they had a much better plan for homesteading. And so he had this idea that according to the Ohio law, they had to plant apple trees within 5 years of staking their claim. So he went to Fort Duchesne, which was near modern day Pittsburgh, and spent days picking the seeds out of the pumice that they had turned into apple cider. And then went down the Ohio River and started planting apple seeds.
And this is from the last tree he planted.
It's from the last remaining tree that survived.
Got it.
There are several others that have claims to being, you know, a Johnny Appleseed tree, but this is the only one that has been verified by historical documentation and from apple experts at the time.
Why was finding this particular apple tree so important to you?
I had have a degree in horticulture from Colorado State, and I had always dreamt of having my own edible nursery. And so I came back to Fort Collins and started gathering the plants that were recommended for our area. And many of them just were not available commercially, so I had to graft them. And many places where you could get them were from Cornell University in cahoots with the USDA, had a large apple collection. And so I went down the list, and while I was there, I found the Flower of Kent apple, which was the tree that Isaac Newton was sitting under in 1665, which gave him the idea for the law of gravity.
This is possible to keep pieces of that tree alive for centuries.
It is, because this branch, even though this tree is 5 years old, this branch is only 1 year old. So you take the one-year-old piece and graft it onto roots, and it's 1 year old again.
Ah, amazing.
So you can keep apple tree and many plants in a state of juvenility just through the process of grafting through the generations.
Now, wait, do you have that Isaac Newton tree here?
I do. That tree. It's called the Flower of Kent.
How did you discover that this Johnny Appleseed apple tree was available?
Well, the only reason I bring up the Flower of Kent is that made me start thinking about, are there more historical trees?
Yes.
And so I started looking for them, and I thought, surely somebody would have these trees in their collection. And phone call after phone call, no, we don't have it. No, I don't know. You might try this place. You might try Ohio State. You might try their substation in Wooster, Ohio. And everything was no. Johnny Appleseed's trees were seedling trees, and apples often resort to being wild trees. Not that their fruit's not valuable, still valuable, but modern people want to have the apples that taste delicious. And Johnny's trees weren't necessarily that delicious.
At least, oh, wait, Johnny Appleseed's apple trees weren't necessarily that delicious.
No, they were useful. They were sweet, but maybe they were mealy. Maybe they were good just for apple cider or for baking or for feeding to cows and pigs.
Aha. And so I imagine that that made these trees less desirable and maybe more elusive for you.
Right. And that was the other thing, too. They were very elusive because at the time of the pioneers, there were just few settlements. And now Ohio's got this grand population. And so the old orchards at the edges of the village are now neighborhoods.
I see. So these trees, these original orchards, wind up fading into the background. Yeah. And become really difficult to find. But you found them.
Yeah. So my wife had given me a book. It was called The Book of Apples. And in there, there was one paragraph about Johnny Appleseed. And they said that there was one tree still alive in Ashland County, Ohio, as late as 1961. And so that was my lead. And so my mother is a librarian. She said, Scott, if you're going to try, the smartest person in town is usually the reference librarian because all they do is read. And sure enough, I called the reference librarian at the Ashland Library, and she said, hold on, let me get the file out. And she had kept a file on Johnny Appleseed because he lived in Ashland County.
Amazing.
And in the file, there was notes which said that tree had died in the mid-60s. And I was kind of devastated.
Heartbroken.
All my hard work. And I said, do you know whose farm it was on? He goes, yes, it was on the farm of Roy and Dorothy Funk. And I think they're still alive. And she got the phone book out and gave me the phone number. And I called up the number, and Mr. Funk answered the phone. And he was very old. And he said, hello. Hi. And I introduced myself and told him I was looking for the tree of Johnny Appleseed. And he says, hold on a moment. He said, hey, Dorothy, get the scrapbook out. There's a young feller wants to know about the Johnny Appleseed tree. And so he got out and I asked him, I said, did anybody ever take cuttings? And he said, they did. Hold on. And I can imagine him thumbing through the scrapbook. He goes, here it is. Some school children from Brunswick, Ohio, came down to visit the tree on an Ohio field trip. But they're the only ones who did it. So that was my big lead. So I called up the Brunswick School District. And this was the early 90s. So early 60s to 90s. That's only 30 years.
Yeah.
So the teachers could very well still be living. And sure enough, I found, after quite a few wild calls that didn't lead me anywhere, I found the teacher had. And she could not remember the name of the student. But she remembered the man who received the cuttings, and his name was Bill Eisen, and he was an orchardist and had an apple bakery that he turned the apples into apple pie, and he had the tree still.
What a story. And it makes me think, gosh, that every tree I pass has a history too, has a family tree, for lack of a better term.
Right. The thing that I always remembered from this was that the reason why that the school children had gone down to visit the tree is because it had appeared in the front page of the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper, and the headline was The Last Remaining Tree of Johnny Appleseed. Mm-hmm. And so all the people that read that newspaper article in 1961, they could have gone down, the Ohio State University professors could have gone there, apple nurseries could have gone down and gotten cuttings of it.
But it was school kids.
It was a seventh grader.
That's so cool.
A seventh grader had saved that tree from being lost forever. The last tree of Johnny Appleseed.
Is Johnny Appleseed, to some extent, I don't know, like an inspiration for you?
You know, Johnny really has. When I think about his life and how he would give away trees in exchange for hospitality, that is an inspiration to me. And I work for a profit-making nursery, and that's necessary. But I always have felt if someone really wanted a tree and something that I had, I would give it away. Hmm. I had, in the spirit of veneration for Johnny Appleseed when I first received my cuttings. If anybody ever wanted it, that's what they got it. And so a big nursery in Oregon called Raintree asked for cuttings, and I just sent them to him. And he says, what do you want in return? I said, nope, it's for free.
I was reading up on Johnny Appleseed just because I knew more of the myth in a way, or the lore, than the man. He was vegetarian.
Yeah, Johnny was an interesting man because he believed in non-cruelty. He didn't believe that grafting was even something he wanted to do, because you had to cut the top of the tree off and then cut the scion off and then put it together.
Whoa.
That he didn't believe in. That's why he believed in planting seeds.
Tell me about the elm tree on this property that's connected to George Washington.
Oh, that's a locally famous tree. George Washington, after the Bunker Hill, which started the Revolutionary War against Great Britain.
In Massachusetts.
Rushed to Boston and signed into existence the Continental Army, where the British were bunkered down in Boston, and Cambridge was where the Americans had control. So that tree got to be known as the Washington Elm. And
he sat beneath it?
He sat beneath it and signed it into existence under the Washington Elm at his headquarters in Cambridge. And as the years got older, the tree started to decline. By 1920, the tree was nearly dead, but the local chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution propagated the tree and then sent to the various chapters
of the DAR.
And the one of the trees survives still to this day in Loveland, Colorado. And it's now was a school, but now the school's been torn down and there's a Walgreens there, but the tree is being protected by barriers so that cars don't smash into it.
But you have one here.
Yeah, and so when that tree is now, from 1920 to today, when I propagated, it was 90 years old, and I thought, oh, that's worth propagating. And I took cuttings and it roots fairly easily, and I propagated and I gave them away. And so George Washington High School in Denver, there's one on their grounds there. And then there's another in Colorado Springs. And I gave one to Fort Carson in Army Base down there. I don't know if they're survived or not, but it could well still be alive. But we have ours right in the field still.
The notion that there is a tree connected to George Washington that's next to a Walgreens in Loveland is a bit of a contrast, Scott. I want to talk about your passion for horticulture, your own history, if you will. Your dad helped you develop that, correct?
My father was very interested in gardening, and same with my mother. My mother was actually surpassed my father, but back in those early days, my mother was, you know, busy with four children. And
I'm just going to say the fans are kicking back on in this greenhouse where there are, oh my goodness, I mean, there must be hundreds of pots of all sorts of seedlings and starters. This is a place teeming with life. But your parents encouraged this.
They did. And so I started planting vegetable gardens and then flower gardens, and then became very much interested in horticulture and studied it straight out of high school at Colorado State. But I didn't finish that time, and that's why I ended up in the Army.
Yes.
You know, when you don't finish a college degree, it limits your possibilities.
When you were in the Army, is it right that you used to save the cores of apples that you and your family ate?
I certainly did. And that was on the first day of in the Army when I woke up and realized where I was. I was like, oh no, what have I done? But that's the first day, you know, when they really are hard on you in basic training.
Yeah.
But I had decided that about that time that once my 4 years are over, I'm going to get out and I'm going to go back and use the GI Bill in horticulture. So I started reading all these books on horticulture, and then I wanted to teach myself how to graft. And after several years, I found myself in Belgium.
Yeah.
at NATO headquarters in Mons. And we rented a house from a Belgian family, and they had 50 fruit trees in the backyard. And so I said, I'm going to teach myself how to graft. But I had no rootstocks. I had no pots. So I saved the apple seeds out of my cores. I saved my half-gallon milk cartons for their pots, poked holes in the bottom, figured out how to grow the rootstocks, planted them in my milk cartons, and then the following year, I went and started propagating the trees from the backyard. And this one, just out of a book. And fortunately, I think my life would be completely different if I had failed. But about half of them made it.
And they're probably still growing in Belgium.
Oh, they certainly are. So the next year I did that, but I did, instead of six, I did hundreds of them. And I went to all my neighbors and gave them away. And then the ones that I had left over, I went to the hospital and made an announcement on the intercom. And because this was, at the time, NATO had 16 different countries, all these Europeans came pouring out from Germany and France and the Netherlands and the UK. And I could name them all, but just to save some time, they all took one. I'm sure they would go back, but there was a particular officer, he was a doctor from Germany, and he said, "Sergeant Skogabau," my German accent's terrible, so I won't even try, but he said, well, I will try. He says, "How long will it take before these trees will bear fruit?" And I said, "Oh, sir, probably 5 years or so." He goes, "Oh, I won't be here by then." And I said, "Well, you know, we have a saying that I've read that a man has at least made a start at understanding the meaning of life when he plants a fruit tree, knowing that he may well never sample the fruit."
Oh.
And so the officer said, good point. I'll take one.
Trees as legacy, Scott. Trees as legacy. How all of this will live well beyond you.
Right. That's the thing about trees, is that they can live for centuries. That Flower of Kent apple tree from Isaac Newton,
yeah,
it's still alive. And it was alive in 1665. The story behind that one was, by 1815, the tree had been preserved just because of its historical significance for the law of gravity on his mother's manor house.
Yes.
And a storm came through England and blew the tree over. And any tree that wasn't historically significant would have been, "Oh, the tree fell over, let's just turn it into firewood." But no, they just let it stay because it was still alive. And the trunk was now laying on the ground. And in rainy old England, the trunk rooted. And now that tree is young again.
I like that the lesson of gravity happened several times with that tree, didn't it?
Good point.
Yeah. Back to the Johnny Appleseed apple before we go. How long before these bear fruit? Am I going to be alive?
Yes, you will be.
Okay, good. And they're not going to be that good. Have you tried a Johnny Appleseed apple?
Oh, I certainly have.
Okay.
Yeah, and the man, Bill Eisen, back in Ohio, who had received the cuttings from the seventh grader in the early 60s, I asked him if the fruit was any good, and he, "Well, I suppose it is." I said, "Is it good for fresh eating?" He goes, "Oh, heavens, no." He says, "What is it good for?" Then he goes, "Oh, it's really good for chucking at cats." And so I am not cruel to animals. I've never tried it. I never will. I love animals. But I did try the fruit, and it is not as bad as that. It's got a sweet flavor. It's crisp. It's crunchy. It just is bland. It's kind of like a Red Delicious, but blander, if you can imagine that.
We'll have to try one someday from these cuttings. What do you say?
Okay, deal.
Thank you so much for meeting us here and for the stories.
Oh, you're welcome, Ryan. It's been a pleasure.
Propagator Scott Skogabau of Fort Collins Wholesale Nursery. He's featured in the new film, A Branch of Us, from Denver Botanic Gardens. It runs through March 23rd at the Gardens.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
In the 1980s, a federal program to revolutionize home building kicked off in Colorado. It started with a dozen suburban homes designed to minimize energy use. They're still around, but the program never took off. And an owner wants to know why. CPR's climate and environment reporter Sam Brash has some answers.
John Avenson fell in love with his home more than four decades ago. The year was 1981. He was a young engineer at the Bell Telephone Company, and like people all over Metro Denver, he caught an ad for an upcoming event, a passive solar parade of homes.
Over 100,000 people came to visit, a dozen homes from Boulder to Aurora, and I thought that this was the best design of the 12.
Avenson bought the plans and had a version built in Westminster. He takes me to his backyard to explain what makes it just so amazing.
So here we're facing the south side of the house. You can see it's three floors of edge-to-edge glass. Once the sun passes through glass, it's the greenhouse effect. The light turns into heat.
And the heat, it rises to the apex of the ceiling where a fan feeds it into a 10-foot-tall box full of river rocks.
And then you live off the heat of the rocks at night.
All this leads to a pretty ridiculous amount of energy savings. In the winter, Avenson says his heater requires a fraction of the power it takes to run a hairdryer. And that led him to write us with a question. Why aren't more homes like this one?
I am so passionate and angry that all homes are not built this good because our country would be totally off of fossil fuels by now.
Now, Avenson has already gathered a lot of the answer. One of his living room walls is a history of the home. At the top is a copy of a front page from 1978. It shows President Jimmy Carter getting off a plane in Colorado to announce Sunday, that's two words, a new holiday to celebrate the promise of solar energy research.
Today, in directly harnessing the power of the sun, we're taking the energy that God gave us and using it to replace our dwindling supplies of fossil fuels.
That was Carter about a year later, after he put solar panels atop the White House. This was the heart of the 1970s energy crisis. That's when the Middle East cut off the U.S. from cheap oil, leading to long lines at gas stations and a spike in home heating costs. In response, Carter called for a moonshot.
By the end of this century, I want our nation to derive 20% of all the energy we use from the sun.
To take on the challenge, Carter called on the Solar Energy Research Institute, or SERI. The federal facility was right here in Colorado. It had hundreds of scientists working on early solar panels and passive solar homes. It actually organized that first tour Avenson attended. But by that time,
I will do my utmost to justify your faith.
Ronald Reagan had won the White House.
So the big question is, why did Reagan and the White House staff canceled this research project?
To find out, I called Dennis Hayes. He not only organized the first Earth Day way back in 1970.
Relevance to this talk, I was the executive director of the Solar Energy Research Institute.
And he can confirm, that home tour was a huge hit.
As I recall, one of the home builders actually had to rip out all of his carpets after two weekends because so many thousands of people had gone through that they kind of destroyed the carpets.
This was by no means the end of the program. Hayes and his colleagues had plans to replicate it across the country. But the storm clouds rolled in later in 1981. The Reagan administration went to Congress and cut the lab's budget by 75%. Hayes resigned in protest.
It was a bloodbath, so bloody that it would be really difficult to ever restore it to the kind of prominence that it had previously enjoyed.
The cuts killed the home building program. Hayes suspects it was about Reagan's ties to the fossil fuel industry and the nuclear industry, but he can't be sure.
Why he was so hostile to solar is mysterious. Solar energy that's compatible with a conservative version of people taking increasing control over themselves and not relying upon distant forces.
Today, SERI is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden. It's flush with cash and rushing ahead on new green energy projects. But Hayes still fumes that China is the top producer of solar panels and Germany is the capital of green building. In another world, he thinks the U.S. and its homes could be miles ahead of the competition. I'm Sam Brash, CPR News.
And that story came to us through Colorado Wonders. What do you wonder about living in Colorado? Send us your questions, cpr.org/Colorado Wonders, and we may answer it on air and online. And that is Colorado Matters for today. I'm Ryan Warner. Thanks for spending time with us. You're with CPR News and KRCC.